The Southern California Linux Expo is proud to present Gideon Rahm.
Good afternoon. I hope you had a good lunch. My name is Gideon Rahm. I'm CTO of Symbio Technologies, and I'm proud to be a core LTSP developer. LTSP is the Linux Terminal Server Project, which is an open source project to basically create a paradigm shift back basically to the future. It's a paradigm shift going back to the mainframe model, or the server-centric model. During the 1980s, I'm sure you've heard this in some of the other lectures as well, during the 1980s was the big PC generation, where we went from this paradigm in computing of going from the server-centric model of mainframes and dumb terminals to the PC model, where everybody had a PC on their desk. Well, that was fine back then when every PC, every desktop could be an autonomous unit and you didn't really have to share files and whatnot and you didn't really have to maintain so many of those units. But now with the great complexities that arise in systems with many computers, the paradigm shift is starting to shift back, not only for cost purposes, but for ease of maintenance and for the cost involved with the time and the maintenance, the deployment, the upgrades, and the repairs. So what is the real cost of deploying personal computers in a network environment? That's the first thing I'm going to address. Next is going to be the network terminal alternative to PCs. And finally, how are schools, governments, and businesses, that large and small, that are savvy enough to start adopting this model once again, how are they capitalizing on this paradigm shift? How many people out here today use personal computers in their work or school? Okay. How many of you actually have files on those personal computers that are personal or personal data stored? How many of those computers are actually backed up on a regular basis within your organization? Okay. So that's a pretty small minority there. And I think everybody has this kind of story that they have about the day that they needed that really essential file and all of a sudden the hard drive went kablooey or something became corrupted and all of a sudden all of their data was lost and it wasn't backed up and it wasn't recoverable. But this isn't a conversation about backing up and recovering data. This is a conversation about how can we deploy the desktop more intelligently. In the personal computer model, all programs, data, and processing are all stored on one box, and that box sits on your desk, and each box is autonomous. One of the things that you can argue is this is great from a redundancy point of view, because if you have 50 individual computers, well, if one of them breaks, I've got 49 others that are full-blown computers and that I can go and work at if the network was configured properly. But from an IT point of view, each of these 50 computers needs to be updated, needs to be upgraded, needs to be maintained, repairs have to be done. Even if you're going to argue that you can take care of most of the maintenance through software, through the careful use of scripting or the careful use of mounting or the careful use of centralization, there are still repairs and whatnot to those individual machines that make the total cost of ownership of a PC dramatically high. Every PC to an IT person, if you're an IT administrator, you should view every PC as basically a cheap server. Okay? It's a server, it's doing everything that a server would, but it's made out of cheap hardware, so it's doomed to fail and it's doomed to be replaced. In most organizations, PCs get replaced once every 3 years or so, or upgraded. But I can purchase a PC for less than $500. A lot of times you get this argument that, especially with Dell and the price of hardware going down, that the price of PCs is really becoming infinitesimally small, so why should I care? Well, what exactly is the cost related to that PC? $500 is the purchase price. It's not necessarily the cost of maintaining that PC over the lifetime of that unit. Each PC, because of all of the local storage, is identical at only one point in time, and that's when that hard drive is imaged. And from that point on, when the users get their hands on it and when users touch it, that each individual PC is different from every other individual PC, and that's what makes it a maintenance and management nightmare. Since each PC stores its own copy of everything, there's a non-zero cost to maintaining it. And this is often a cost that's not factored in. Let's look at the network terminal model. In the network terminal model, there's absolutely nothing on the desktop hardware itself. And let me explain the network terminal model. The network terminal model is where you have a box sitting on your desk that's a dumb terminal. What's a dumb terminal? It has zero local storage. It has a motherboard, it has memory, it has a network card, and it has a case. And that's basically it. And when you turn the switch on, it sends a message to the network saying, give me my operating system, give me my settings, tell me where to log into, log me into an application server somewhere. And that's when it gets life, and it's a completely stateless machine. So what's good about that? Well, with no local storage and no local operating system, there's nothing really to upgrade, because there's no software inside the box. There's no software in the box to go wrong. So I can deploy 50 of these network terminals in my organization, and that same network terminal that works today can work 10 years from now, 20 years from now, because it doesn't have the local software in it that will need to be upgraded, on the one hand. And on the other hand, it can be made a completely solid-state unit, because I've taken out the most unreliable part of the PC, which is the hard drive. Why is the hard drive unreliable? Because from a hardware point of view, it has moving parts. And everything that has moving parts is doomed to break earlier than something that's solid-state. So here, if I just have a case, and I have a motherboard, and I have memory, so the possibility for failure is reduced dramatically, and the reliability is goes through the roof. Each box is anonymous. Because they're stateless boxes that are sitting on everybody's desk, I can log into one just as easily as I can log into another and be presented with all my information, because all of my information is coming from the server naturally. I know in a lot of products, not as much in Linux, but in other operating systems that suffer from this, is that it's very difficult to control, once you have local storage, it's very difficult to control where the user saves data, whether they save it on their local machine or whether you can train them to save it on a centralized server. In our case, with network terminals, there is no local storage. There is no possibility for user error. Everything is maintained on the server. What else is nice about a server-centric model? Well, I'm booted into an application server. If I need to upgrade software on my server, I upgrade it in one centralized place, and then it's available for my entire company, for my entire organization, instantaneously. I don't have to image the hard drive and ship the image out 50 times in order to upgrade software on everybody's machine. And I have every bit as much control over which users have access to which data, which users have access to which programs, which users have access to which parts of the network. So really, these boxes that are sitting on my desk, no maintenance required. And I can push out just as effective a desktop as I could as if it were a PC. So there's no hard drive, so what? Okay. As I was saying, no hard drive is no locally stored OS, programs, or data. I don't worry about it. I don't worry what's out in the field. I just need to maintain my server, and everything's fine. A $250 dumb terminal today will have a total cost of ownership of not much more than $250 over its lifespan. And its lifespan is going to be a lot greater than that of my PC. Something to think about. So from terminal to PC, why did we shift away from this to begin with? We were using mainframes originally. If you pick up any 1979 Unix administrator's guide, you'll see references to booting up computers networkly over the network. So why did we make this shift to begin with? Well, part of it was a deficiency in the hardware technology that was out there. The network back then could very well support a blinking cursor. I don't know how well it could have supported Macintosh or Xerox's new GUI that they were pushing out to the desktop, because the network bandwidth just wasn't there. There was also a more immediate need for local processing power on everyone's desk in order to deal with all of the local kinds of software packages that were being developed. So you had this PC paradigm that became very popular. Also, the price of these mini computers and microcomputers was going down, and so it was no longer cost prohibitive for even smaller companies to get into the game and have a computer of their own rather than having to invest in a mainframe, which most of them could not do. And ultimately, there was an increasing market for home computers. So people wanted to use the same computers at home, you know, that they were using effectively in the office. And so there was a snowball effect, and the PC rose to power. But if you think about it from an engineering point of view, is a PC in this day and age where, or even if you take it to the limit, in a day and age where there's infinite bandwidth between computers, and there's and you can place anything where you want, where you would like to, does it still make sense to have a PC on every desktop? Or was the original model that was conceived actually the better model? Because now, from a management point of view, there's no reason to have local storage on my desktop, so why put it there? I should have a desktop that is reliable, that I don't even have to think about. And me as the IT administrator should be answering all of my users' questions over the phone, and I can fix any user problem from my desk. So why haven't we shifted back yet? Well, we've had about two decades right now of this ingrained PC environment inside the office place. And to tell you the truth, a lot of people don't even remember the old mainframe system. I don't know, how many people in this room remember working off of a mainframe and a dumb terminal? Okay. It's still a very small percentage. But many of the people who have been working with computers over the last two decades haven't been exposed to anything other than PCs and don't even know that there are other paradigms that exist. So the other thing that we've been waiting for is we've been waiting for a server-grade, multi-user, mainframe kind of operating system that could also present a desktop that was usable to even the simplest of user, a GUI desktop, and that could run well in an environment where the application server is a very interesting server, right? Because at the same time, it has to be server grade. It has to have the server muscle. It has to be reliable. But at the same time, it's presenting stuff to the user. So it has to be user friendly. It has to present a good desktop. So what have we been waiting for? Well, enter Linux and LTSP. Sure, this probably could have been done with Unix, you know, in a wholly expensive proprietary fashion. And in a lot of places, it was. Before I got involved with this company, I used to be a circuit designer. I was actually working out here in Silicon Valley. I was working for HP. And as a circuit designer, we do a lot of CAD. And we work on, in general, a Unix environment. And I've gone through many iterations with the IT staffs as to how that environment actually looked from in the very beginning actually having a big hunking either HP or Sun workstation sitting on my desk or underneath my desk, and that's what I worked off of, to the point where they realized that it was much more efficient to just have a very large compute server for computing, you know, these types of CAD things, and that's where you shifted off your jobs. And eventually, I was left with a Microsoft Windows desktop that ran Exceed, if anybody's familiar with that. That's, that was a Unix emulator, basically, that allowed me to bring up X Windows on my PC desktop, and that allowed me to do all of my regular desktop functions, but tap into Unix for all the type of CAD design and whatnot. But this was a day and age before Linux, you know, like was hitting its stride, and before Linux could even think of offering up a desktop that could compete with the desktop options that were out there. I don't know if they're going to Linux today, but I wouldn't be too surprised if they could use a Linux desktop and connect to the Unix much more easily. So we were waiting for Linux, and Linux has been developing since 1991, as everyone here knows. And We've been waiting for the Linux Terminal Server project. So what is LTSP? LTSP has been developing since 1999. It was really originally invented to meet a customer demand where they needed a way to deploy an entire network of, let's say, 50 to 100 terminals, all connecting to a mainframe and providing, you know, like a few basic applications. And they needed to do this in such a way that it would not take a team of 3 to 5 to 6 IT administrators to administer the network, which is about typical, you know, like if you're talking about a 50 PC network. Remember, in the LTSP kind of environment, in this network terminal kind of environment, if you have 50 network terminals in your business, 50 desktops equals one computer. How many IT administrators do you think it takes to take care of one computer? Half? In the business world, they like to talk about half engineers. I've never really fully figured out, you know, like how much of a half engineer makes a half engineer. But if you're talking about an enterprise solution, right? So if you're talking about an environment where you're going to have thousands of PCs, I don't even know how they do it today. I don't know. I don't even know how they're even moderately successful in that venture, because each PC is this own autonomous unit that you have to maintain and control. And then think about multiplying that by 1,000 and getting it all networked. The complexity is mind-boggling. Whereas to me, 1,000 workstations, I don't know, 20, 25 servers, 20, 25 computers. How many IT staff does it take to maintain 25 computers? 2, 3? I don't know. Versus an IT staff to take care of 1,000 computers, you're talking double digits probably by then. So how does that impact the bottom line? How does that impact the total cost of ownership? Is that even factored in? Well, arguably, it should be. Now, one of the questions that LTSP gets. LTSP, the idea behind, one of the main ideas behind the project, is that you can take a server and you can boot up these diskless thin clients, these network terminals, and you can boot them back into that server that is booting them up, and that server will serve as the application server. So it's this nice, neat, you know, like self-contained kind of unit. And LTSP, being the Linux Terminal Server project, is doing this all on Linux, so you're serving up a Linux desktop. So a lot of people ask, you know, well, does LTSP limit me to this Linux desktop and this Linux application server? And the truth is, not at all. This is one of another interesting effect of this server-centric computing. I can have a Linux server, a Windows terminal server, a Mac Xserv, a Unix XYZ operating system, all in my back room, an IBM 3270 mainframe, an AS400 mainframe, all in my back room. And you know what? Linux has clients to all of them. So from my in my network now, let's say I was only interested in deploying Windows and Linux applications to my users. Well, I could have a Windows terminal server and a Linux terminal server in my back office. And now I have the ability to push push applications that would run on either OS back to my end user, just simply through a terminal services kind of environment. So now, let's say I have 50 workstations. So in my 50 workstations, I have my 2 servers, and I can run, you know, I would say 80 to 90% of the applications that are available on the market. You know, not too shabby. Add a Mac Xserv, you know, like maybe you get a few more, you know, Unix, you know, maybe you get a few more. And it all just takes advantage of the basic fundamental building blocks that are X-Windows, that is X-Windows. So LTSP runs on a Linux server and boots the terminals, but it can connect them to any of these different types of application servers. And the truth is, if you wanted to sell a company on this network terminal kind of paradigm, and they were staunchly against using Linux, staunchly against moving away from Microsoft at all, consider putting in a Windows terminal server and a Linux boot appliance or boot server and booting up these diskless workstations into a full Windows environment. And you've just pushed Windows to those 50 machines, and you've reduced the complexity of having to manage 50 Windows computers to the still overwhelming complexity of having to manage one Windows computer. Okay, do I need to buy special terminals? No. One of the nice things about Linux, and this really is very much in tune with the notion of open source when it comes to software, this you can consider open source when it comes to hardware. Is there any particular special hardware that I need for a network terminal? No. All I need is a motherboard, a video card, let's say, if it's not integrated with the motherboard, a network card if it's not integrated with the motherboard, some RAM, and a case. And that's all it is. The way that the network booting happens is in one of two ways. It can either Pixie boot, which is a protocol that's in a lot of the newer BIOSes ever since around the Pentium 2 timeframe. The motherboard manufacturers have been integrating Pixie boot capability, which is network boot capability, into the BIOS itself, or along with the BIOS. Or if that's not available to you, if you want to use your old 486 that you got out of the garbage and recycle that or refurbish that into a network terminal that will run, by the way, every bit as well as a brand new Pentium 4, if not better, because everything's running on a dual Xeon server, no doubt. So you actually get the power of the server, not the power of the computer. So let's say you want to resurrect one of those old 486s. So there are ways to do that where you can... there's a great open source project called Etherboot, which allows you to put a piece of code onto some sort of medium, be it a ROM chip that would sit inside the network card, or even a floppy disk, and actually reuse that computer as a network terminal. There are some proprietary solutions out there by some big companies, not Microsoft, but other big companies that are, like big West Coast companies that where all the hardware is completely proprietary. You have to buy their network terminals to connect to their servers. And in an effort, basically, to enforce vendor lock-in. And one of the beautiful things about open source and one of the beautiful things about this open source project is that there's no vendor lock-in. And not only is there no vendor lock-in, I've heard a lot of presentations, especially I just enjoyed the last one from Mad Dog, about all the areas in the world where they have are 486s. These are the types of qualities of machines that they get, that they're working with. And all of those machines are beautiful, beautiful dumb terminals. They are, given the right server in that environment, they could revive those machines by the dozens, and they are, in order to create network environments that are as good, completely on par with network environments that are here in the States. So what else can be a network terminal aside from a reused PC? You can buy a dedicated network terminal. Dedicated network terminals are usually these small footprint kind of boxes. And they're basically all they are, motherboard, memory, and all integrated network and video and whatnot. And the idea behind those is that they're all solid state. They usually don't have an internal power supply. A lot of internal power supplies have fans. Your fan on your power supply breaks, your power supply overheats, you don't have a dumb terminal anymore. So a lot of these guys, they have external, those blocks, the same blocks that you would use for your laptop, they would use for the network terminal. So if that should die, then it's easily replaced. But these dedicated network terminals are really nice. They're no moving parts. They can be completely silent. They're very low power. We're talking 15 to 20 watts sometimes as compared to hundreds of watts of power, and they're small. Some thin client manufacturers. Now, this is the interesting part. Dumb terminals, this is a very different paradigm than thin clients that are out there. Dumb terminals haven't existed since the 1970s, where the market for them really hasn't, except for in few select kinds of markets. You might see them in auto body shops and those sorts of things. But there's been this whole thin client market. The problem with the thin client market is you still get this nice small form factor box, but it's got this chip inside of it with this embedded OS. And it kind of defeats the entire purpose of this whole paradigm, because when you buy this cheap little box with this embedded OS, you're basically buying a very small crippled computer. And that very small crippled computer is going to have a lot of the same issues as its big, fat, full-blown cousin. And those that very small crippled computer is going to need firmware updates. It's going to need to be pushed out different settings and different upgrades and whatnot. It completely defeats the entire model. The nice thing about this pure, dedicated, dumb terminal, network terminal kind of model is that everything is on the server, and every time you press that on button, it's like it's a completely new computer. So the administrator has complete control from one centralized point as to all the various settings. And as I was saying before, no vendor lock-in, which is if you think vendor lock-in's bad with your software, people hate vendor lock-in when it comes to hardware. It's that much worse. Your software, you can always reformat a hard drive. Okay, I wanted to give you an example of some, you know, like small network kinds of diagrams, to give you an idea of how this might look from a networking point of view. So here's a network diagram of a small network. This looks very similar. We have a bunch of clients that are small businesses that are on these types of setups. People like property managers, you know, basic office, you know, kinds of people. What you find in the small business world is, you know, like 95% of the small businesses have exactly the same needs, with the exception of one particular program, you know, like that is particular to them that, you know, like holds their business together. So like 95% of small businesses are word processing, email, internet, what, you know, like all the basics that you would expect. And then it's like, well, you know, like in order for my flower shop to stay in business, you know, like I must have, you know, like Flowerifica or something, some software package for specifically tailored for flower shops. And if you're lucky, you know, it can run on wine. But more often than not, it's this one sticking application that, you know, like must run on Microsoft Windows, and they can't use anything else. So, but that's a, yeah. Well, so yeah, that's kind of what this is drawing here. The question was, is it possible to have a couple of other Windows boxes around for the people who have to actually use the Windows environment, Windows applications, right? Ah, okay. So they have their own existing PCs, right? Their own existing PCs running Windows, and they just want to use this as the file server. That for sure can be done, and you can also, because you can put this Etherboot code that I was mentioning before on a disk, you can always make that as a very simple mechanism to toggle between I'm a network terminal, I'm a PC, I'm a network terminal, I'm a PC, whether or not I boot up off the disk or not. It's a good interim solution, but for a more long-term, kind of long-lasting approach, probably a better thing to do is to see if you can get them to get your customer to invest in two boxes in the back room, one that's a Linux server and one that's a Windows server. First of all, it'll keep them from the frustration of I booted into Windows, I booted into Linux, because they're probably not going to do that. They're probably just going to always boot into Windows if they're going to be booting into Windows. But then you've got these other PCs to manage. So, I mean, it's when it comes to the small businesses, that kind of decision is usually made by whoever the IT support is, and how much support they actually want to do. There are a lot of nice side benefits by having a completely server-centric approach, especially when you're the IT administrator, and especially if you're administering small businesses, because you might have, let's say, a dozen small businesses that you do IT support for. And one of the nice things about Linux versus Windows when it comes to IT support is you don't actually have to be on site more often than not to solve problems Whereas with Windows, more often than not, you know, like unless you put in the software infrastructure for it, you actually have to go there and fix the problems. There are a lot of nice kinds of technologies in Linux to be able to do things remotely, even if you needed a GUI. And even if you needed to do something remotely to the Windows machine, there are a lot of great technologies out there and that are really blockbuster and really improving to push Windows over the wide area network, over the internet, and be able to work on them effectively. So in this kind of scenario, you could push that Windows box back to your office just as easily as you can push your Linux box and fix all the problems on that Windows server. Who's that, Windows Terminal Service? Yeah, that's the downside, is that Microsoft will still try to get licensing every way that they could, and they get you for what are called CALs, customer client access licenses, for Windows Terminal Services, which you know, like you actually are on a per-user basis, so it doesn't matter that you're only connecting to it from one machine. It's all the users, simultaneous users, basically, that want to connect. So that's another game that you can play in that arena. But the centralization from a maintenance point of view is, in the small business is great. I can have a tape drive inside my Linux server, and you need to back up, tar, you know, or dump, whatever your preference. You know, and you can back up onto a tape the entire company in one fell swoop. And it's not like having to worry about what files were saved where and who's going to point the finger when the CEO of that company can't find the file that he accidentally deleted 2 days before to, you know, resurrect that. Or if there's a server crash. A lot of the questions that I usually get are, well, aren't you putting all of your eggs in one basket? It's a much stronger basket. These servers, you know, you've seen uptimes for Linux servers and whatnot that are ridiculously high. We've been in business, Symbio Technologies has been in business for 3 years. We've been working off of these kinds of networks for about 2.5. And the only time our server has gone down is when we've taken it down, like on purpose, which is a far cry from some of the other experiences that people have. The other thing also to mention is that you're working off of a server. So people say, okay, well, the operating system's great if it's reliable, but what about the hardware? What if your hard drive fries, you know, your hard drive fries, whether it's a server or it's a PC? Well, when you're putting in these servers, so, you know, one of the things you might want to consider is put in RAID. You know, so put in a bit of redundancy into the server. First of all, the servers are most likely running SCSI hard drives, you know, which have a much higher reliability. And if you want higher reliability on top of that, you can put in RAID. If you're really so concerned, you know, with the reliability, you can even buy two servers, and it's still going to cost you less than it would to outfit your company in the long run with PCs. So here's an example of what I call distributed networks, which are, these are usually larger networks. And examples of these can either be that you have just a really large office complex with thousands of different workstations within that complex. Or, like some of our clients, you might have 100 different offices where each office has only a handful or ranges from a handful of different workstations up to, you know, let's say 100 different workstations. So the question is this kind of network terminal idea, this network terminal model, is it scalable both from the small end to the high end? And I think that it is. It is very highly scalable. And a lot of how you decide to design the network really depends on the particular situation. What I've drawn out here is, so the thing about the boot server with LTSP, the way that LTSP works, the way that it provides the operating system, is as an NFS mount. So basically the entire operating system that the terminal uses is a mounted drive from the server. There are pros and cons to that approach, and there are certainly other open source terminal projects that do it in different ways. The pro to this kind of approach is that it really reduces the hardware requirements on the thin client end, because you don't have to store the entire operating system into RAM. Through some really nice technology out there, you can also use swap space on the server through NFS to compensate for low memory thin clients. So those are a lot of the things that LTSPre, by using this NFS technique, brings to the table. One of the downsides and one of the cons is that NFS is not very secure. But who really cares, because you're pushing out the same operating system to everything. But because it's not really secure and it's not really meant for to traverse like long distances, to traverse the internet, the WAN, you wouldn't want to put a boot server, let's say, on one side of the wide area network and thin clients on the other side of a wide area network. Over a VPN, should be okay. You know, maybe if you have a lot of bandwidth. Remember, in the end, you're still downloading kernels. You're still have file transfer between the two, and you'll always have this live NFS-like connection, kind of like the umbilical cord connection to the server. So it might not be recommended. There are two sides to this game. One is booting up the network terminals, and the other is actually connecting them to an application server. Where the programs will be run and launched. And those don't necessarily have to be the same box. And so if you have, in this kind of scenario, you see over here, what's contained inside this box could be an office in and of itself, which has a switch, a bunch of network terminals, let's say a handful of printers, and a boot server that just boots up the thin clients and directs them where to go. And then they can be making a connection, this connection that they make to the centralized servers. That connection could be X Windows, which is the most uncompressed, the most unfriendly to latencies and, you know, like things that really are the same reasons why it's very difficult to push X Windows over a wide area network. It will be the same kinds of issues that you would have there. But you don't necessarily have to be pushing X. One of the values that Windows Terminal Services in the Windows world, or Citrix, you know, like in the Windows world, bring to the table is the fact that they not only encrypt the data that's going between them, but they also compress them. So the amount of information flowing back and forth, they can actually go over a wide area network. There's a company called No Machine out of Italy that has a wonderful product called NX, which really tries to do very much the same thing with X Windows, where they can encrypt and compress NX using SSH and some X proxy magic, and they can really get a lot of high performance over the wide area network. So one option may be, okay, if I have all of these outlying offices, but I still want to centralize to application servers that are in my central office under my control, but X is too heavy for all the links that I have in between, well, another option may be this NX solution, where it's this kind of compressed solution going back to the application server, and that should run just fine. Why would you want to do that? Why wouldn't you want to put a server in each of the offices? Well, if you're a government agency, and especially in the states, there are a lot of states that are hundreds of miles across, in, you know, like north to south, east to west. If you're a state that has offices sprinkled all around the state that you have to manage, if you put a boot server and thin clients in each of those remote offices, well, those are pretty high reliable. That's a pretty high reliable network, because people aren't banging on the, you know, like on the boot servers, they're banging on the application servers, you know, to do all their work, and all the data is centralized and managed. So, and also the boot server is very easily replaceable, because it has a set duty. It's an appliance, so it has a set configuration. So if something should happen to the boot server, I can send you out a replacement. You plug it in, drop it in, everything works. Same thing with the diskless thin clients. And all of the stuff, all of the maintenance gets pushed back to these central servers or bank of servers that you have in the main office. Okay, who's making the shift to terminal? So are there people actually doing this, or is this one of those open source projects that sort of, you know, stays low key and, you know, it really becomes the play toy for developers and not really into the mainstream? Well, one of the markets that took to this like a fly to honey, I suppose, was the school districts, the school market. And not on a district level, but more on an IT level, the IT administrators saw great value in this because they saw networks that they could deploy as classrooms where they could put implement these classrooms, Linux classrooms, and they could, in one centralized place, control what the kids are doing, what the kids have access to, make sure they can lock down one system. In the educational environment, a lot of times you're protecting yourself more from the users than you are from the hackers that might be coming knocking on your door outside, because the hackers are on the inside, right? So a lot of the game that you play there in terms of maintaining computers that can be used for educational purposes is to make sure that they aren't used for other purposes and that they can be locked down. Well, a school is another example of one of these environments where ideally in this country, at least in this country, they want to have one computer per child, and that's what they're working towards. Well, there are 100,000 schools in the United States and millions of children. You know, the nightmare of maintaining that, especially since most schools don't have IT staff for continual maintenance. And a lot of the schools out there, you know, the gym teacher is the IT guy. And that's sort of where the state of affairs is in the United States, that you need something that's easily locked down, easily maintained, where they can do it once, have centralized control, and be able to deploy it over a large number of users. So schools have loved this. And not only schools in the United States have taken to this, but especially and even more so, schools abroad. There are the Telecentros out in Brazil that made it into Mad Dog speech next door, which are providing internet access to a country that where internet access is prohibitively expensive otherwise. And there are two Linux distributions right now that incorporate LTSP. One of which comes out of Finland or Norway, called Skoll Linux, and another one comes out of Oregon, which is K-12 LTSP, which is basically Skoll Linux is based on Debian. It's basically Debian and LTSP and a bunch of other tools, but specifically geared towards schools. And K-12 LTSP similarly is LTSP rolled into Fedora, and with a bunch of educational packages specifically geared towards schools. So those are distros that they can give to a gym teacher. No offense to gym teachers, if there are any in the audience, but I had a great gym teacher. But they can give it to administrators who are not familiar with Linux. They can throw it onto a formatted hard drive and go from formatted hard drive to a diskless thin client network, reusing all of their 486 donated machines and creating classrooms for dozens of students in a matter of 20 minutes. Who else is using this? Well, my sources reveal that IBM, in their internal deployments, when IBM is planning to roll out Linux, LTSP is a major part of that, a major part of their plans. So, and that's globally and corporate-wide, they're trying to figure out the best way to deploy Linux within their own environments. ExxonMobil, another big name. Libraries find this to be a great asset because for many of the same reasons that schools find it to be a great asset. And many of the libraries these days are using web-based kinds of library automation software and that sort of thing. So the whole question of I am dedicated to this particular Windows application, it becomes a moot point because they can do it through Firefox, all the usual library automation stuff that they already have in place. Government agencies are also looking into this as more government agencies move to open source and move towards Linux. This becomes a very natural approach as to delivering Linux to the desktop. It's very clean, it's very controlled. And it should save them money in terms of total cost of ownership. Cyber cafes, the telecentros fall more under the cyber cafe model in Brazil because it's primarily to give the people internet access. And small businesses, as I was saying before, and hopefully you, yes. Sure.
Just elaborate a little bit on what this provides. I mean, is it just the seamlessness of the whole installation of the idea?
Primarily. I mean, it's they both have very similar agendas. They're both based on different distributions. So Skoll Linux, like I say, is Debian, and K12 is Fedora. And they're both maintained by two different groups. Skoll Linux is interesting. When you pop in a Skoll Linux CD and you go through the installation process, it basically asks you very few questions, but a very fundamental question that it asks you is, do you want this to be your terminal server, or do you want this to be your main server? So one of the interesting things that they did was that, what's a main server? A main server will automatically set up for you Samba, LDAP, like all of the back-end kind of things that are usually important for schools where you're authenticating Windows machines as well as Linux machines and those kinds of environments. So with Skoll Linux, you can make your main server, which will do all of your LDAP authentication, export home directories. That's intended to be your authentication file server. And then your terminal servers are basically application servers / boot servers that boot up your network terminals, and all of the home directories for all the users and all the authentication go back to this one main server. So one example that they like to point to is they, evidently in Norway, you talk about differences in countries. You know, in some countries, bandwidth is very, very much less expensive. So they talk about a particular school district in Norway where they use fiber between all the buildings. And so they can afford to have just terminals within the schools. And even their boot servers are located on the other side of the light over in some centralized office where they basically have five schools in this district. Each school has an LTSP server that's booting each individual school up and serving its applications, but those five schools all point back to one central authentication file server. So any student can move between any of those schools, log in, and get all of their data and all of their settings and be presented with their desktop. That's what's one of the really cool things about this. I know that there are similar kinds of solutions on other platforms and other operating systems for doing that, but for sure, this paradigm makes the complexity of that a lot less great.
Why would you want to use a Skoll Linux type of installation in a small office setting? If you were going to operate, say, as few as, say, 10 networks or bytes?
You could. Generally, the difference between a small office and one of those kinds of environments is the small offices, it's not as cost-effective to split things up into separate boxes. So a lot of times you can put in that one server. That one server is your file server, local file, local authentication. If they're just pushing Linux, you can have a one-box solution where you don't even have to get into the complexities of LDAP or like some sort of network-wide authentication scheme. With Skoll Linux?
Yeah,
you can just not use the main option and tell it to authenticate locally. K12 LTSP isn't as complex. They don't give the two different options. It's more if you've ever installed Fedora before, basically there's a screen where it asks you if you want it to be a personal workstation, personal workstation server, or custom. So there's another little bullet item under their LTSP server. And you click on that, and it sets it all up for you. But they're both, you know, like very valuable kinds of things in their own right, and they both incorporate different educational tools and whatnot. But because of the amount of success that LTSP has had in the schools, the development on those kinds of soup to nuts distributions has been very rapid. And there's one of the other nice things is that there's very close collaboration between the LTSP community and the K-12 LTSP community and the school Linux community. So that always helps in the open source environment. Is there commercial support? So that's a good question that you'd want to ask of any open source project, especially if you expect the open source project to be adopted. Usually having some sort of commercial backing leads to greater adoption. And the answer to that is yes, and it's growing. Symbio Technologies, when the company was founded, weren't doing LTSP per se. But when we discovered LTSP and decided to focus the company's effort around it, we sort of looked around to see who else was commercializing LTSP, who else was going to both contribute back to the open source community and at the same time give those same IT administrators who did those kinds of pilot networks within their schools the ability to go to the district chairperson and say, we want to do this district-wide, and here's a company that you can call and holler at, you know, instead of having to rely on calling and hollering me. And if I get hit by a bus, here's a company that, you know, can support you. So there really was no, or there were very limited options that you had at the time of companies. Jim McQuillan, who's the brainchild behind LTSP, it's, you know, like his baby. He created the project in 1999. He has a consulting gig of his own, and on the side he has DiscusWorkstations.com, which is a joint venture between him and two other folks. But it's kind of a side project for all one of them. You know, so there you know, again, that was basically the extent of the commercial support that was out there. So we decided that this was something that we wanted to dedicate our time towards both development and commercializing products out of. So one of the first things that we set out to do was to create management software. And we created this web-based management software, which we ultimately GPL'd a great part of it, to control and to administer LTSP, whereas when we got into the game and you first tried to set up LTSP, we were pretty technical people, and it took us a good 6 weeks or so to actually get it running. Once we got it running, it was fabulous because we had this like gutted Pentium 1 machine, presenting us with a login screen, with no hard drive, and that's like a thrill factor in and of itself. But it took time. It took time to get it right, and it took time to get it right on for particular hardware, different hardware configurations on the thin client end, which could have been tricky. If you want widespread adoption, you need to create tools that make it easier and especially in this kind of genre of software, which is administration software, which is geared towards administrators. Not all, most of the administrators out there in the world are coming from a Windows environment, and don't even know, wouldn't know a terminal if it, bit them in some place. Let alone being able to install software on Linux, let alone being able to install Linux. A lot of people have trouble with that. So if you can present them with a web-based management tool that presents the options clearly in a simpler kind of fashion versus telling them, well, this is the magic code that you have to put into this particular text file in order to, get this particular thing to work, that's basically what any kind of GUI development is working towards, the ease of adoption of these kinds of systems. So that's a big part of the value add that we as a company bring, as in addition to feeding back into the core engine of LTSP and working with the developers to make the core engine better. Also, what's interesting is what we've seen since we've been doing this is that the number of vendors producing terminals specifically for LTSP, these kinds of dedicated thin clients, is increasing. And some of that is due to our effort, I'm proud to say, because a lot of the very first thing that we did when we stumbled across this project is we peeked our head up and we looked and said, okay, this is such a great project. Now, if I'm a business, I'm going to want to buy dumb terminals or these network terminals. Where do I go? And, you know, start doing these Google searches, start looking out there to see, you know, like, who has dumb terminals? And then dawns on you, you know, like, well, there hasn't really been a market for dumb terminals in a very long time. The closest thing that's out there are these thin clients that I was mentioning before that have these embedded operating systems. So we spend a great deal of time. We spend a great deal of time, and we continue to spend a great deal of time trying to populate the market just with these kinds of boxes by calling up these thin client manufacturers and saying, hey, if you rip out that chip and send us the product, can we get it a little cheaper? Because you're saving a little bit on hardware. And to which they usually respond, but it's not going to work. And we say, don't worry about it. Because by the time you explain it to them, they still don't understand. Who are they? The vendors? You've got vendors like Televideo, Vic Corporation. If you're in the thin client business, these are the kinds of names that they throw around. There's Devon IT, which is another big one. A lot of the newer terminals, even without trying too hard, they can actually be used as dumb terminals, even if you don't remove the chip. Because what's as a phenomenon that happened is, so Pixie booting started getting incorporated into the BIOSes. So if they didn't, if the thin client manufacturer didn't emasculate the BIOS, to the point where it didn't do what it was originally designed to do, then a lot of times it'll have network booting capability. And what you also find is a lot of these thin client manufacturers are also getting keen to this whole Linux thing and want to sell you an embedded Linux thin client, which does, you know, like from our point of view, tells us that this particular piece of hardware can be made to work on Linux. Like, there are drivers for the video card that's embedded. There are drivers for the network card that's embedded. So so for us, that's a good clue. You know, both of those two kinds of trends are proliferating the market with boxes that are usable as these kinds of dedicated thin clients, which is good, because ultimately, even if you replace your PC and you gut the hard drive and whatnot, it makes it a more reliable computer for sure. But you still have internal fans, and you still have internal power supply fans and whatnot, which eventually will die and will cause the system to overheat, and eventually you're going to run and replace it. Also, if you're in the front office, you know, having a big hulking 486 machine on top of your desk is probably not what you want your customers to see for when they first come through the door. Everybody likes nice and sleek. So the convergence... just to conclude, the convergence of Linux, high quality and high bandwidth network hardware, low cost commodity desktop hardware, this enables us to revisit this whole kind of desktop delivery paradigm, whether or not we need to deliver the desktop on an individual PC, or is it more practical and more efficient to be able to deliver it on a stateless type of device. And as a result, have a simpler, more manageable kind of network architecture. And what's nice from a global point of view and from a social point of view is that it does go to lengths to close this kind of digital divide that there is around the world, because everybody can find pretty much 486 machines. And we're at a state in the game where, you know, like the industrialized, you know, like wealthier countries will throw away Pentium 3s. You know, Pentium 2 hardware, and it's the poorer countries that will collect these as donations. Well, when you refurbish them or recycle them, or however you want to look at it, when you give them this new life and you breathe new life into them as network terminals, Well, network terminals run at the speed of the server. So if you can get high-quality servers into these countries, you can have networks of dozens, hundreds, thousands of computers that operate just as well in the poorer countries as network paradigm works in the more wealthier countries. So it's not like there's the wealthier countries are always one step ahead of the game. And that works on a country level. It also works on a business level. Linux has helped scores of small businesses compete with their larger competitors because it eliminates the lock on the software. Well, this takes it a step further and allows your small company to save, just like the big competitors that you're fighting against, in saving on the hardware costs in addition to the software costs. If you want more info on any of this stuff, I ask you to either look at our website, thesymbiont.com. The Symbiont is what we call our solution, just to be distinctive from LTSP. There's ltsp.org, which is where the home of the Linux Terminal Server Project. K12 LTSP, as I mentioned, Skoll Linux. And like I say, probably any 1979 circa Unix admin guide is going to have a lot of information about these kinds of network architectures, because what we're really doing is we're really going back to the way things were. Any questions?
Do you ever use the Mini-IDX?
Yeah, for sure. In fact, in a lot of our own, so as a result of not being able to find so many thin clients of these network terminals, we set out to have a line of our own. Especially when you call up these thin client manufacturers and you tell them we want to resell your product, but we want to like gut it, they're not really so keen on having their name on it originally. So a lot of our, I would say the majority of our network terminals are these VIA-based boards.
What about having little USB drives that people can plug in? Is there any way to handle that?
Yeah, there's support. In our product, there's support for it already. In the next version of LTSP, there's going to be support for it within the open source project. We've been sometimes being the kind of commercial side of this thing, we're often faced with those kinds of requests of, will USB storage work, because that's a must. So for us, from a business point of view, we have to make it work, and we have to make it work any way that we can, which may not be the most elegant way. From the point of view of the open source project, we want to make sure that what goes into the open source project is done a little bit more elegantly, so we can come up with our own hacks, which often inspire what ultimately gets done and get stuff to market sooner. To address those problems, but ultimately, to ensure the quality of the open source project, that stuff lags behind a little bit. So, yes. Wireless thin clients are interesting, and I'll tell you why. And with wireless network terminals, because wireless is inherently not necessarily stateless, because of encryption and because of the configuration parameters that are involved with it. And unlike wired networks, there's no way right now to divine those kinds of settings from the server a priori, before the machine is actually booted up. So when we're faced with that question, we have a number of different solutions. There is a, within the open source project of LTSP, there is a wireless package that you can put on a floppy disk that will work with PCMCIA wireless cards, and it has certain drivers within it, and it has a file that you can edit on that floppy drive where you can edit all the settings and whatnot. From a commercial point of view, it's a little too messy, to support. So we've taken the stance of, what's a very good solution is a wireless bridge. And if you have a wireless access point and you have a wireless bridge from the network, if the wireless bridge is connected to the network terminal doesn't know that there's a bridge there. It's completely transparent. So that's one way to make a network terminal wireless. Take that a step further is that what we try to promote in most cases is the formation of wireless islands. So take a library, for example. So a library, they usually have these nice big round desks where people will sit at. So take a round desk, put four or five network terminals on it, feed them into a five-port switch, plug into one of the ports a wireless bridge. And now you've created a wireless island of network terminals without, A, having to incur the added expense on a per network terminal basis for putting wireless in each one, and B, when either you need to reconfigure the wireless side of the network, it's very easily done through a web page because the bridge has all that built into it, or if you want to move to the next wireless standard, because the wireless standards are getting faster and faster by the month, if you want to go from, let's say, G to N in a couple of months, so you can do that very easily just by swapping out the hardware, as opposed to having to open up a network terminal, maybe like take out some sort of embedded PCI card or something along those lines. So that's usually how we answer wireless.
What?
It depends. It depends how much wireless you're doing. Wireless is a broadcast medium. It's a shared medium. So what happens is if you're doing 802.11b, right, so you're chewing away at your bandwidth really quickly. They say 802.11b is 11 megabit per second. It's really, in terms of throughput, maybe 4 or 5. And that's if you're able to really maximize the use of the channels, because there are 12 different channels in 802.11b, and only 3 non-overlapping, right? So it's on shaky ground to begin with, right? 802.11g and then 802.11n, which support much higher bandwidths, you can probably get a lot more terminals on a single connection. You have to remember with this whole boot server thing, there are basically two different kinds of modes. One is when you turn the terminal on, and at that point it has to request the kernel, download the kernel from the server, and then create this NFS mount, and that's going to form its operating system. But once it's on and it's running, so that's kind of a burst mode, right? Once it's on and it's running and it's continuous, So it has kind of a heartbeat, it checks the NFS. There's, usually some sort of X traffic or some other kind of traffic along the line. Every time a program is launched, it has to get it off the NFS. But once you launch X, which is usually what you're doing to begin with, so it doesn't have to relaunch it again. And also, that's another thing. As I mentioned, this NoMachine NX protocol before, which does kind of compression along with encryption of X. Wireless is an excellent application for this in the network terminal world because you can use that to try to pack more of those sessions going through the wireless. Because there is. I mean, we've been working on integrating the NX client into LTSP, which we pretty much have done, but again, we don't have it as elegant and as seamless as we'd like it. So that would be one solution. Another solution that we're looking to towards is an SSH-wrapped X solution. Not to get too much into internal politics, but from what I understand, the X guys don't really like the way that the NX guys get achieve their results. So they kind of see it as cheating the X protocol. So, but at the same time, the X suffers from a lack of security because every time you log in to another machine using XDMCP, from a GDM login screen, that username and password is going through in clear text because X dates back a long time, and it's something that they still haven't resolved. So we're looking into wrapping X within SSH as an alternative to NX as a way of securing it up. And if we do that, then SSH has some compression functionality within it that we can experiment with, too.
Yeah.
that's kind of on the radar.
Interested in local printers, PCB layers on the box.
Okay.
Yeah,
I got to remember to repeat the question. So the question was local CD players and local printers on the box. So right now there's support for local printers. Basically, the way it works is within this environment, you have to think about your point of reference. Okay, so the reference point within this environment is the server is always local, right? Wherever your applications are, that's local. Okay. And what we have a mechanism where when the terminal boots up, it can start a printer daemon so that it looks like a JetDirect printer, like a network printer. So you can set it up on your application server to point to the workstation, port 9100, just like you would a JetDirect printer, and send jobs to it. If you set up a local printer on your server, that a local printer refers to something plugged into the server, not plugged into any of the particular workstations. CD support, data CD support is there, you know, so to be able to pop in a data disk and be able to read from it and copy files to the server. Music right now is not, music CDs aren't supported. And usually in this kind of environment, it's the kind of environment where the people who are going for this kind of environment aren't really the same people who would really suffer from not having music CDs being able to play on the thin clients, which is why the development of it. Sound sounds interesting. Sound works in most cases. I'll give you a brief snapshot of the state of affairs of sound in the Linux world when it comes to this kind of network stuff. When you push sound across a network, there are various different architectures for doing that right now. There's one called NAS, which is Network Architecture Sound, something along those lines. Don't hold me to that. There's ESD, which is the Enlightened Sound Daemon, which is what GNOME uses for its environment. There's ArtsD, which is what KDE in general uses. And all of them work to varying degrees over the network, and with different sound cards, obviously. You know, the older sound cards don't have as much of a buffer, so they can start sounding like a broken record. But for most of the applications and sound support is there enough to be able to do interactive gaming, like flash gaming for kids in within an educational environment. It's the kind of the way that the state of the of LTSP is now. You probably, unless you had gobs of bandwidth, would not want to be doing things like full motion video, video editing, that sort of thing. And a lot of that is because primarily the paradigm right now within LTSP is that you're running something off the server, pushing it back to the terminal. One of the nice flexibilities of LTSP is that doesn't have to be the case. You can have local applications run on the network terminal that are started on demand, basically from the server, where you can set up an icon, you can set up SSH access, let's say, to the terminal, set up an icon on the desktop that launches through SSH an application on the terminal to run on the terminal, right? Which, why would you ever want to do that? You're probably thinking, well, in terms of any kind of real-time application that requires real-time access to the thin client hardware, that becomes a must. So if you're going to talk about voice over IP, big topic in this conference, one of the topics also on the radar for incorporating within LTSP. So now I have a diskless thin client that's also a telephone, right? That'd be kind of cool. Well, in order to be able to effectively do voice over IP, since it really requires things in real time, it either means that you have all of this kind of sound interaction very well controlled and very well buffered over the network and very clean lines and low latencies in between and everything like that. Or you just launch your voice over IP application on the thin client, just like you would as if it were a PC, and it has direct access to your sound card, which is the much easier route. Of course, then you just need to make sure that you have mechanisms in place so that you can control which user is launching the application and that sort of thing, like authenticating the users and making sure that it grabs all the right settings. So it's interesting. This paradigm also makes you think a lot more about where is the processing done? Where are my applications being launched? What applications are being launched where? If I had a very heavy, let's say, database application or Java application, I may want to launch that, even if I were running on a PC, I may want to launch that on a compute server or something like that, in which case I would be doing the same thing. I would be setting up an icon, or I would have some sort of job management program that would take the process and ship it off to that much larger server. So, you know, these kinds of things have been done in the Unix world and have been the thought processes of Unix administrators forever in Unix environments. And now we're just sort of playing with them a little bit more and extending the idea in LTSB. Yeah?
Could you speak to the size of the server, the actual, you know, how many processors and how much memory?
Sure. I mean, one of the other advantages that we have, the question was about the server scaling, the server size appropriate for different numbers of users. One of the luxuries we have is that for most of the users in the world who are using general types of applications, it's not very CPU intense. You know, your average PC user doesn't break 1% of their CPU utilization on average, right? And that's really what it all boils down to when you're talking about an application server and scaling the application server is how many users are going to be on that server at one time and what are they going to be running. And that's what determines not only your CPU, but also your memory and whatnot. So let me give you some concrete examples. And we like to do overkill when we sell this commercially, just you know, because user experience is usually the what people are rating you on. Things like that. So we usually push GNOME. GNOME is a heavy desktop, like KDE. Heavy in the sense that it has many processes that get loaded into memory and therefore takes up a lot more RAM to be able to provide the kind of functionality that they provide. Typically, in an office, running office applications, web browser and whatnot, if we had an office of 20 users, we might be looking at about 2 gigs of memory on the server. And when it comes, it's interesting. Launching applications, a lot of it depends also on what you're looking for. If you want your application to launch really quickly, right, and you want high reliability on the server, RAID is a very smart option, right, to RAID your hard drives. Because let's say you do RAID 5 across 4 drives, so you're getting a 4x increase in reads, you know, read access off the drive. When you're launching programs, you're like reading the information, not writing the information. So programs launch like before you even think about it, and you can get like really kinds of high performance. That's one of the things. It's hard to really deliver effectively in a speech like this, but server hardware really is very different than PC hardware. Even though PC hardware has gotten so high performance, server hardware really, the backplanes are much bigger, in terms of bandwidth. The memory is much more robust. The access time for memory is much more robust. So you get these environments where you wouldn't believe the kind of speed that you get off of these applications. And what's even better is that since the server doesn't have to really handle any of the display stuff, because the displays are all pushed back to an X server that's running on your thin client, so it frees it up from having to worry about actually painting the screen, right? It just has to worry about running the applications. As a result of that kind of segregation of resources, you're really making the best use of the hardware that you have, and things really do come up lightning fast, and the performance is just incredible, and you would not believe it. You would not believe, looking at the hardware that's on your desk, the performance that you're getting out of it from your server.
So in that scenario, the server is administered by one of the workstations.
What do you mean? Well, even if you had, the question was about whether or not you would be hooking up a monitor to the server in that scenario. Even if the server is managing the single display that's, you know, like on its local console, on its local host, it doesn't have to manage all of the displays of all the workstations that are connected to it. I guess, you know, it was more of my point, you know, so that, because managing a display takes up a lot of memory. If you do a top, you know, like on your system, you'll find that GDM or KDM or, you know, like whatever your display manager is, takes up a good number of the resources just keeping all the displays together. If you can eliminate that, you know, or push it off to another machine, which you are in this case, it doesn't have to factor into your overall budget, you know, processing budget.
I'm gonna cut you off there. So
okay.
You guys are welcome to continue the discussion as you need to.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.